Hope everyone had a good morning. We're going to start the afternoon program off with a panel, Branch Rickey, the Pittsburgh Pirates Years. And we're really fortunate to have an expert moderating this panel. I think many of you know Sabre member Lee Loewenfisch. Lee is the author of Branch Rickey, Baseball's Ferocious Gentleman, which won Sabre's Seymour Medal in 2008. His first book, The Imperfect Diamond, The History of Baseball's Labor Wars, is now in its third edition and is a pioneering work of baseball labor history. Lee has contributed many articles to Sabre journals, and his work has appeared in the New York Times, the New York Daily News, Nine Journal, and many other publications. As we've been doing throughout the day, if you have any questions, please write them on cards, and then we'll bring them up at the end. And now let me introduce Lee.
It's a tremendous honor for me to be here today. Sabre has meant a lot in my life. I joined in 1976. I met Tony Lupien at Sabre and Paramus in 1978, and we wound up doing the first edition of the labor history, The Imperfect Diamond. And at the Baltimore Sabre in 1984, I got my first quote in Sports Illustrated, actually my only quote. It was a quote of the week. I said, they call us baseball nuts, but they forget that a nut is a very fine fruit. I'm not sure that would be printed today, but, you know, things change and things don't change. So today I'm so pleased to introduce our panel. When I did the Rickey book early this century, I got to meet Jeff Flannery at the Library of Congress, where he still works in the manuscript division. And he will lead off with the story of the Rickey papers and also wonderful events happening at the Library of Congress. This is really the golden age for baseball research. And I was at the Cooperstown Sound Symposium, the annual one on American culture, just a few weeks ago. And the keynote speaker up there was Carla Hayden, who is the new librarian of Congress and the first librarian in the history of that position who is actually a librarian. And the exhibit that will last for a year on baseball, it opens next week at the Library of Congress. And when Jeff speaks, he'll talk a bit about that. Our next speaker will be the original Frank Thomas. Frank Joseph Thomas. Frank Joseph Thomas, who grew up near Forbes Field, started in the Pirate Farm system in 1948, and he came up to stay by 1953. And Frank has some legacy pictures to sell to you, and you'll hear about that from Frank. And last, and certainly not least, I'm honored to have Jack Bowen here. Jack is the father of Jackie Bowen, Jack Bowen Jr., who was honored as the Scout of the Year yesterday at the luncheon. He's the grandson of Rex Bowen, who was one of Branch Rickey's top scouts from St. Louis to Brooklyn to Pittsburgh, and then later with Cincinnati. So I can't wait to get started. So from the Library of Congress Manuscript Division, please meet Jeffrey Flannery.
Thanks, Lee. It's a real honor to be here today. I did my education here in Pittsburgh back more years than I care to remember, but it's just a wonderful town, wonderful city, a baseball city. So it's just a thrill to be back here. And today I'm going to talk about the library's collection of Branch Rickey's papers in the manuscript division at the Library of Congress. And the manuscript division collects, preserves, and makes available for research use primary source documents of the American past. We have the papers of 23 American presidents, from George Washington to Calvin Coolidge. We have members of Congress's papers, government officials, literary authors, civil rights figures, and other American notables like Branch Rickey. We have about 65 million items in the manuscript division. This includes diaries, correspondence, scrapbooks, and in addition to Rickey, we also have collections relating to baseball for Jackie Robinson, Arthur Mann, who was a journalist who worked closely with Ricky, and Glenn Martin, who was very active in the American Amateur Association for Baseball. Our Ricky papers have 29,000 items. They're in 87 containers or boxes, and the division is open to any researcher above high school age who has a research purpose. But the collections of the library go back quite some time relating to baseball. There's a very famous mural on the ceiling of the Great Hall that depicts a baseball team. You can see this. It's kind of done in the classical Greek scene. But this that building, the Jefferson Building, which is the original library building, was built in 1897. And they included a baseball team on it. So our collections go back that far. And even further back, we have the diary of a student from Princeton from 1786. That was, I might remind you, before the United States Constitution was created, where he wrote one day on March 22nd, 1786, he said, "A fine day, play baseball in the campus, but I'm beaten, for I miss both catching and striking the ball." So we have references to baseball that go back to the 18th century. This is a guide. This is our guide to the Ricky papers. It's available online. It describes the content. It doesn't list all the contents in the collection, but it describes and gives you an idea what's in there. So this finding aid has breaks the collection down by box, tells other important information when the collection arrived, whether it's open or available, and this is available on our webpage. Here's a picture of the Ricky papers. This is something you won't be able to see because we have them in closed stacks. So I went back into stacks, and this is just a picture of the 87 boxes. It's minus a few there because I had taken some out to make ready for this presentation. But this is an actual item from the Ricky's papers. This is a shot of Forbes Field that was part of a menu for the Schenley Hotel that Ricky had kept in the collection. And so this was about the time when Ricky was the general manager there. And some of the items in the collection that I thought might be interesting. This is a letter from Bing Crosby to Branch Ricky in 1951. Ricky had just started working with the Pirates then, and Crosby was a part owner. And here, Ricky had traveled out to California. They had met, and at the conclusion of the meeting, Crosby was writing a couple of things down to some notes about the meeting. The one thing that you may not be able to read there, but in the first paragraph, Crosby says, "I am an adult and quasi-intelligent, and I don't believe I have to be a baseball expert to appreciate that you are on the right track." So here he's kind of telling Ricky that, he's getting behind him and the changes that he wanted to make for the team. Then a little later on, he asked Ricky if he'd be interested in maybe taking a barnstorming team to South Africa because Crosby was friends with a golfer from South Africa, a professional golfer. So they were trying to get interest in that. And when Ricky replied, among other things, this is a copy of his response. Of course, he tells Crosby to take care of himself. Not surprising to anybody who knows Branch Ricky. He had a kind of a paternalistic air towards everybody. But then he also showed some interest in in this idea. And whether anything became of that or not, I'm not sure. I haven't had a chance to go through the collection. But we would certainly invite anybody to follow that up. Ricky started doing evaluations on players, and this one is a memo that he wrote to his son, Branch Jr., who was a team official, and this is about Bob Friend, and he says here, they're talking about how Friend, the one thing that I thought was interesting here was that he only had three complete games in 1951 season, which today would probably qualify for big things. Yeah, Cy Young. So anyway, but one thing to keep in mind about this is if anyone's interested in doing research in the collection is that these are player evaluations, but they are not part of the scouting reports that the library recently put online for Ricky. So these player evaluations are scattered throughout the collection. So it's important to note that not everything is indexed, not everything is online. So researchers who want to come down and look into a particular player who may have played for the Pirates at the time really have to go through the collection itself. So that was an example of that. And then here is a letter from Rex Bowman, who was who's the grandfather of one of our panelists today, written in 1951. And this is about a player, a fellow named Dick Hall, who went on to play for the Pirates and for the Baltimore Orioles. And one thing that Mr. Bowen said about Hall was that he thought that he wanted $50,000, which he says is a lot of money, and it certainly was back in 1951. And he said, he is a funny boy, and he has wasted a year by fooling around this summer. But I do not question his attitude towards baseball or his competition spirit, his competitive spirit, despite his actions in the workouts in Pittsburgh. So, again, this is a narrative description of players. Again, you're not going to find it on the online scouting reports. So if there's one thing you take away from today is that the scouting reports, the 1,700 or so scouting reports that the library put online, they're not all up there. They're scattered throughout the collection. Well, I'm in Pittsburgh, so I couldn't say. I had to say something about the Steelers. And, of course, there is something about the Steelers in the collection. This is a letter from Art Rooney. Ricky was today I think we would call him a motivational speaker. He was certainly on the lecture circuit. Rooney went and heard him in 1952. And the one thing that I caught from this letter was that Rooney wrote to him and said, "I hope you will forgive me when I say it's terrible that you have to grow old. I wonder if you can be replaced." So, I'm not sure how he meant that. This is the online presentation of our Ricky scouting reports. They went up around opening day here this year. So again, we have about somewhere between 1,500 and 1,700 scouting reports online, mostly from the 1950s when Ricky was with the Pirates, and then a significant group from the early 60s when Ricky had gone back to the Cardinals and worked as a consultant with them. So if you're going to come down and visit us in the manuscript division, what do you need to know before you come down in Washington? You need to know where we are. We're in the James Madison Memorial Building. That's on 101 Independence Avenue Southeast. We're right across the corner from the Capitol Building, that big building with the dome. We're open Monday through Saturdays, 8:30 to 5. We're closed on federal holidays. We have top-rate facilities. Nope, that's not what the reading room looks like today. This is what it looks like. You want to go to our webpage before you go there. That has the most information about the collections in our facilities. We have scanning facilities there for researchers to use. Who want to make copies of materials. You want to check our webpage. You might want to look around our catalog. You want to look in the finding aids. I think the last time I looked, I did a search of our finding aids, which provide descriptions for our larger collections, and we had at least 67 collections which listed baseball as in the finding aid. And I also want to invite everyone to come down to see the library's big exhibit on baseball called Baseball Americana. I think it's going to open on June 29th. We're going to have materials there from the Hall of Fame, and not only from the Hall of Fame, but from the library's collections. The featured item, I think, is the rules of baseball that were compiled in 1857. It's only been on display once. Out on the West Coast, so this is the first time it's going to be on display at the library. So please consider visiting Washington and coming down and seeing the exhibit. We're also excited about a new project that's going to start in the fall. This is the Citizen Historian Center. where we're going to launch a transcription project that's going to feature, among our other collections, but the Branch Rickey papers. If you go to the online version of our Rickey papers, they are in a certain order. It's mostly chronological and alphabetical within, but you can't do keyword searching. You can't even search for the players' names. So we're reaching out to the public to see it through this crowdsourcing project to add this, I think the term of art today is called metadata. Don't get scared of that term. It's just adding an index. So we're hoping that folks will take advantage of that. You never know who you're going to meet at the manuscript division. So come down, join us, and we hope to look forward to seeing everybody. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jeff. I should mention that, as in other sessions, if you have questions, please write them on papers. I thought these were already questions, but these were the ones to John Candelaria. And if you weren't here, that was pretty memorable. Our next speaker, who I owe a great debt to, because he came in yesterday as a sub for Dick Grote, who has the flu and couldn't make it. And this is the original Frank Thomas, except no substitutions. This is Frank Joseph Thomas, a lifelong Pittsburgher, and he has something to share with you and to tell the story of what it was like in his career, where he hit almost 300 homers, almost 160 as a Pirate in his prime years of from 53 to 58. So it's my great pleasure to introduce from Oakland, Pittsburgh area, now Ross Thomas, the original Frank Joseph Thomas.
You write my speech? Thank you, Lee. Well, I'm pinch hitting for Dick Grote, all right? Dick Grote has a flu, from what I understand. And Lee called me. I guess he called the Pirate office, and Joe Belladeau gave him my number, so he called me and didn't tell me anything. Didn't tell me if I had to speak or anything. He says, "You're going to be on the panel." I says, I will be more than happy to do that, all right? Now, I came here this morning, and it took me 50 minutes to get to this hotel because I had all the streets blocked off, and I live here, and I know all the side streets and everything like that, but they even had those blocked off. So I had a tough time getting here this morning. But as I look around here, you know, I feel right at home because this is the kind of crowds that we used to have when I played. We didn't draw very many pictures. And then I look back, when I was a kid, I'd go to Forbes Field and I'd watch the Steelers play. There was only 1,000 people in the stands. But look at them now, all right? And up at the Pitt Stadium, you know. Times have changed. Baseball has changed. I don't like it. I don't like some of the things that they're doing for that particular reason, all right? I don't like the designated hitter. I think it takes something away from the game. I don't like the idea of, trying to hurt somebody, but sliding into a bag at the right way, I think that should be done, okay? I'm from the old school, and the only two clubs that play the game of baseball the way baseball should be played are the Cardinals. You know, they get a man on second base, you got to believe that man's going to be at third base with the next batter. And then they get a fly ball or a base hit and they score. That's the way the game of baseball should be played. And it should be played. And they're not teaching it in Little League or anything like that. You know, it's the big money, okay? Everybody's swinging for the fences today because they want to make the big money. I'm going to tell you what my first salary was. My first salary at Tallahassee, Florida, in the Georgia Florida League was $150 per month in 1949. All right? And I had to take care of my room, my food, and everything else. But what helped is when you hit home runs down there, they took a collection. If a crowd like this, they took a collection, okay? They'd bring the money into the clubhouse. The clubhouse boy would dump the money on the table, and he'd take out what every one of the 20 ball players owed, and then you got the rest. So that's how we did. My first major league contract in 1951 was $5,000, all right? I came from New Orleans in 1952. I had a great year at New Orleans. Dale Long and I were back-to-back with home runs, okay? I beat him out, and we had a great year between the two of us, and we were always friends, okay, great friends. And, you know, he's passed away, his wife passed away, and as you get older, and you people are going to realize this, you lose a lot of friends, and your friends are smaller and smaller each year, okay, in that light. But when I came back in 1951, they brought me up to Pittsburgh, okay, and they really didn't play me the way I would like to be played, all right? And then they sent me back in 1952 to New Orleans, all right? And I had the great year. And I asked Mr. Rickey at that particular time for a $1,000 raise. And his answer to me was, we can't pay major league salaries to minor league ballplayers. And I says, isn't you playing for next year's salary? And he never gave me an answer for that, okay? So the next year, 1953, my first full year in the major leagues, which is still a record, hit 30 home runs, drove in 102 runs as a center fielder. I don't know how many of you knew that, okay, but I'm proud of that. That has stuck for a long, long time, and it doesn't look like it's going to be beaten with the way the Pirates are going right now, all right? But anyway, after the 53 season, I went in, and I said to him, Mr. Rickey, I'm a major league player now. I want paid accordingly. He says, what do you want? I says, I want $15,000. He said to me, he said, you go along with me, and I'll give you $12,500, and you have another good year, then I will take real good care of you. I says, okay. I signed the contract. I had another good year. I walked in, and what do you think he offered me for the contract that year? The difference on what I had asked for the year before. And that's the year that I held out, and, you know, Jeffrey talked about Mr. Rickey. Mr. Rickey and I, we had our problems. He treated me like I was dirt under his feet, treated Grote like a king, all right? Kiner and I both, to be honest with you, I will not say anything bad about him or anything like that, you know. I just feel that the way I was treated wasn't the way I should have been treated. The stuff that was put in the newspaper about me, I had nothing to do with it. And I told Mr. Rickey that my dad is interested in me the same as you're interested in your son, and I walked out of on the meeting. Now, if we would have had agents back then, because we went in and talked contract by ourselves, all right, and they had the upper hand because we were slaves back then. We couldn't go anywhere. We either sign or we don't play baseball. And if you love baseball as much as I love baseball, you sign, okay? And I had a laugh when I listened to Jeffrey up there and saying that we have all this stuff on about Rickey, but nobody has ever put anything in the Library of Congress about the letters that people wrote about that didn't like him. It's the same with the Hall of Fame. Hall of Fame is for the stars, okay? Yet, there's only 6,000 major league ballplayers. We're all ballplayers. We're in the major leagues, okay? They did not have the record that I set that I'm going to talk to you about, okay? I had to go up there and tell them they never asked for my bat, when it happened, like they do with all the other teams with big stars, okay? And why? You know, why is it that they always want to talk about the big stars? And if any of you have been to the Hall of Fame and you go through the building and you look at all the Hall of Fame plaques that are up there, you will see that most of those players are from the big market cities. Very few in the small towns, okay? Very few. And it's a shame because of that. I don't know how much time I'm going to have, but I'm going to speak for about 3 hours. I mean, does anybody want to get up and talk? Let me tell you about the picture that you're seeing on the screen right now. Let me ask one question first of all. How many can tell me, I asked Jeffrey this before he came in, how many can tell me who holds the record for the most home runs as an expansion team? And what is that record?
34 and it's you.
Pardon me?
34 and it's you.
Very good. Very good.
In New York.
That's when it happened. And that happened in 1962, so it's staying there for a long time. No more. Okay, now, how many of you sitting in this room know that what happened on June 8th, 1961? Not the ones that I already talked to, but how many of you know what happened that day? Nobody? Okay, let me tell you about it. From the time baseball was invented in the 1800s until June 8, 1961, this feat has never been done in Major League Baseball. When I was with Milwaukee, we as a team hit 4 home runs in succession in one inning by 4 different Brave players. Eddie Matthews hit the first one in the 7th inning off Jim Maloney in Cincinnati. Hank Aaron hit the second one off Maloney. They brought in Marshall Bridges, the pitcher Joe Adcock, who hit the 3rd one. I made baseball history when I hit the 4th home run in succession. Out of all the players, the great hitters that have played this great game of ours, I'm the first that has ever done that. And the pictures... And I brought this picture with me, hoping that maybe some of you who are collectors, you have to be collectors if you belong to the Sabre, right? Okay. And I sell it for my charities. And my charities are Happy Days and Special Times of Loving Answer for Children with Cancer and Courageous Kids, a Safe Haven for Children with Cancer. I've been with these kids. I've been playing in a softball game with them, helped them swing the bat, carried them on my shoulders, running the bases, big smiles on their faces, and it makes it so worthwhile. My wife and I, before she passed away, we had 8 children. We had 7 living and 1 deceased. We had 4 boys and 3 girls, or 4 boys and 4 girls. So I always told my dad I was twice the man he was, and he belted me a couple of times because he only had 2 and 2. But I've been doing this now, and people say, why? Why are you doing it? Well, we lost a daughter when she was 17 years old. And I will say this to all of you people sitting in here today who are married and have children. Spend time with your children because you don't know how long you're going to have them with you. Okay? We had our daughter for 17 years. Today, parents don't have their kids. They're in trouble. They skip school when they're not supposed to. Right? All these things that they do. Okay? And I can tell you a story that happened to me when I was here in Pittsburgh. Bob Prince, the announcer at that time, and Judge Broski asked me if I would go to the hospital to visit a little boy who was dying of cancer. And I'm the type of person that does things like this. I'm probably the only major league ball player that writes a letter to everybody who sends for my autograph. And I've been doing this because I vowed when I was a kid that when I made the major leagues, not if I made the major leagues, but when I make the major leagues, I will not pass up a kid, okay? And I have kept that vow. It got to a point where every ball club knew exactly what to do as soon as I come out of the clubhouse. As long as they lined up, I would stay there and sign until everyone has left. And if somebody would cut in, I would tell them, end of the line, we'll get to you also, okay? And I kept that vow because of my what I thought was right to do. And if I had to catch the bus to go to the airport, I would tell them, write me a letter to the ball club, and you will hear from me. And I have done this my whole career, and I still do that. And I'm out of baseball now 52 years, and I get on an average of anywhere from 5 to 10 letters per week. And that kind of tells you something when you have that reputation. And I get beautiful letters from kids, okay, thanking me for writing to them and telling them these things. But getting back to that story, so I went to the clubhouse and got an autographed baseball by all the players. I took the yearbook around and had each one sign it and went to the hospital. And I walked up to the door, and the nurse says, Stevie, you have somebody here that would like to talk to you. And Stevie wouldn't smile for anybody, wouldn't talk to anybody, wouldn't eat. And when I poked my head in, a big smile came over his face. And the nurse says, you know who that is? He says, yes, it is. It's my favorite ball player, Frank Thomas. And I walked over, and I sat down, and I spent about an hour with him. And in the probably halfway through, he must have got a pain. He said, Mr. Thomas, can you hold on a minute? I'll be more than happy, you know, I'll be okay. So I waited, and then we talked. And then when I was leaving, he said, Mr. Thomas, would you do me a favor? I said, yes, Stevie, I'll do it. I said, if I can't do it, I'll get somebody to do it. He said, no, you can do it. I says, what do you want me to do? He says, will you hit a home run for me? And I looked at him. I said, Stevie, we're going to Chicago tomorrow. And when I hit the home run, you're listening to the radio, you know that I'm hitting it for you. First time I come up, count 3 and 2, rubbing the sawdust out of my bat, I swung and I missed. And I'm very religious. And on the on deck circle, I just put the bat there and I said, dear God, not for me, but for the little boy whose life you're taking back home. And the next time I got up, okay, got to count to 3 and 2, I hit the ball out of the ballpark. And I got my return. I got my answer when the game was over. When I went into the clubhouse and on my stool was a telegram from his mother. And it said, Mr. Thomas, no sooner you hit the home run, Stevie passed away. Wow. That's a true story. And I tell that for the reason why I tell you parents to spend time with your kids, because you don't know how long you're going to take them with you in that respect, okay? On this picture that is here, Adcock, Aaron, Matthews, and myself. How many people could tell me how many home runs were in that group?
Yeah.
I mean, you're all Sabre people. You should know the research, right?
Frank, after the panel is over, Frank will be selling that picture right here. So that's a very, very moving story, Frank, and I want to bring up Jack Bowen next. So
oh, was my time up?
Yes.
You didn't tell me that. You told me I could talk as long as I wanted to. All right, okay. But I want to tell you one story before I leave, okay? For a long time, because we had 8 children, my wife tried to teach me how to diaper the baby to no avail until she started to use baseball language. She said, let's believe the diaper is a tarpaulin. Wrap home plate upon the pitcher's mound. Do the same with first and third bases. Spike it with a safety pin, and again, we have a dry field. Thank you very much.
We will now hear another side of Branch Rickey. We're all part of one big baseball family, aren't we? And my friend Jack Bowen is Rex's son, father of the Scout Award winner yesterday with the Pirates. Jack grew up in a baseball family, and he's going to talk about his experiences growing up in baseball. Jack?
Well, I'm going to stay right here if it's all right.
Oh, sure.
And I told him I'd show up and make some comments on what the rest of y'all said, so that's pretty much what I'm going to do. Frank is right when he said he didn't make much money. None of the old parts did. Elroy Face, they asked him one time what the difference between a splitter and a forkball was. And you know what he said, anybody?
Money.
About $10 million a year.
Well, he never said that, though. He said money. He didn't mention the figure.
I remember when Elroy wanted to get married, and he was dickering with Branch Rickey about his salary. So, and I think he was trying to get $500 over $5,000. That sound about right? And he was in the major leagues already. Don't feel bad, Frank. Maury Wills, my dad signed him for $500, and he went to the minor leagues and played there for about 8 or 9 years before he made the majors. Rickey was trying to sign good ball players with potential, and he was trying to get them cheap. And they ran a lot of tryout camps, and I used to go to some of them with my dad, and I'll tell you what they looked for in a young ball player, because Branch Rickey told him to do it this way. They wanted him to be clean-cut looking young men. They wanted him to be able to run and throw. If they could run and throw, they figured they might be able to teach him to hit like Frank Thomas. He used to hit him over the clock there at Forbes Field. Remember that clock? How high off the ground was that?
How can I forget it?
Yeah, it was real high, and the balls used to fly right over the clock. Well, they figured that some of the guys they could teach him to hit. They might get bigger and stronger if they had good bodies, but they liked to know that they could run and throw. If they could do that, they wanted him, with one exception, which explains why Dick Roat is probably one of the big stars that Parts have ever had. He had something that a lot of guys that could run and throw didn't have. Rickey coined this phrase, I think. He called it body control. Guys like Wayne Gretzky, they're not bigger, they're not stronger, they're not faster, but they can just play. They try to do something, and by golly, they're able to do it. Grote was like that. I think I could run as fast as Grote, throw almost as well, but he had great body control and could hit the ball on the nose time after time. If he had gone to a tryout camp and they ran him, he probably wouldn't raise any eyebrows or anything. He wasn't a fast runner. He had a fairly good arm. He went in the hole. He got the ball over there quickly and accurately. But in a tryout camp, he probably wouldn't have raised any eyebrows at all, and he wouldn't have hit the ball 400 feet. He might have been noticed because he had good body control and good hands, but Rickey used to send his scouts out to basketball games and football games when he had a player he liked. He'd send them out, and he wanted them to see them play football and basketball, see how they reacted and how they played. He also wanted them to sign boys that were clean-cut and was religious if possible. He liked clean-cut young fellows. And if they saw, back in the 50s, guys used to have ducktails. It just drove Rickey and my dad crazy. They said, son, you're going to have to get your hair cut. And I went to spring training with Rickey's Dodgers couple times, I think 47 and 49, I think it was. And he used to give speeches to the guys. I don't know where Frank was ever at one of his speeches or not, but he would harangue them on how to play baseball. He'd get all the ball players in one room down there at Vero Beach. These were Dodgers at the time, and he'd talk to them about how you should play baseball. And he'd lecture them, and it would go on and on. And one of the things he did, I was at one of his lectures one time, and he brought out one of the scouts, one of the old scouts. I think it was Jake Pittler or something. Remember Jake Pittler?
Oh, yeah.
Or somebody like that. And he came out on the stage. He had one of his socks rolled down. His shirt tail was out. His hat was on cockeyed. And everybody knew something was up. And somebody intoned from the side of the stage, "This is not the way you look when you're a Dodger." And of course, he wanted everybody to look well, and the Dodgers always wore their uniforms beautifully, and so did the old Pirates. So that was that's sort of the thing that Ricky looked for in ball players. He wanted speed, a good arm, and good body control. And the sabermetricians these days, they want to see the numbers a lot, but in those days, it was all potential. You're looking for somebody who might be something good. And I finished Michael Lewis's book, Moneyball, not too long ago. And I found it very interesting. He goes by what a player's done, not what he's capable of doing in the future. And it was very interesting. I think the mistake he made was he started out by insulting all the old scouts. Now, the old scouts had stopwatches. That's about it. So they looked at a player, and they could tell where he could run or not. They looked at a fastball, and they could tell where he could throw 95 miles an hour or not. And they knew whether he had good control or not. Of course, that's pretty obvious. And they also wanted to see a pitcher that didn't look like his arm was going to come out of joint every time he threw a baseball. Because, you know, guys like Nolan Ryan and people like that, they were smooth. Dwight Gooden, smooth silk, and they're not going to hurt their arms. Oh, they did sometimes. But they didn't want herky-jerkiness. What else I got down here? Old uniforms. The scouts used to take their uniforms from the major league team when they wore out and they're all laundered out and about ready to fall apart. They'd give them to the scouts, and they'd throw them in duffel bags and take them to the tryout camps and dress up the local guys that helped them out, the bird dogs, etc., and let them run the baseball. And I had them all over the house when I was a kid. I wish I had them now because they're very highly desirable now. I had a bunch of old Dodger uniforms, and I still got some old Pirate uniforms, the old ones without the sleeves in them. Maybe Frank will find this interesting. My dad hired Sid Thrift as a scout and brought him into the office when they were having a meeting. Branch Rickey Jr. was running the meeting, and they were talking about ball players. My dad was moaning they weren't playing Mazeroski. And Bobby Bragan said he needed a shortstop. And my dad and Bragan got to yelling at each other. And Sid Thrift said, I thought these guys were very rational and polite when they discussed baseball players. He found out that was not the case. And nobody could say anything bad about Grote as long as my dad was around. Or Mazeroski. Bragan wasn't playing Mazeroski in 57, and that really irked my father. Mazeroski could do about everything. He wasn't a real fast runner, but he was good. Another thing, I thought I'd just tell you this, anybody's interested, is how to impress a scout. If you're playing baseball, if you're a young guy that thinks he has some ability and he wants to play, you got to make a scout notice you, and you want to throw the ball as hard as you can in infield practice because that might be the only time the scout's going to see your arm. So you don't just toss it over there. You put something on it. If you get a chance to run something out, anytime you get a chance to run, you go full speed, everything you got. Even if you hit a ground ball back to the pitcher, run to first base as fast as you can. And take a good infield practice. Look like a ball player. Keep your socks right. Get yourself some socks that, what do they call them? Those stirrups that go up. And like Joe Pepitone said, you got to look bitching out there. That impresses a scout. They don't like to see a sloppy ball player. What else? Show them that you hustle, and show them that you're a nice kid if you can possibly do that. My dad signed, I got a few of them written down here, Roger Craig, Maury Wills, Bruce Del Canton, Eddie Mixis, Bo Blinsky, if you remember Bo, and my Uncle Joe signed Gene Alley and a bunch of them. My whole family's been in baseball all my life. My uncle played for the Baltimore Orioles, and my dad played 4 years in the Cardinal organization and didn't make the big leagues. But Ricky hired him as a scout because he was a good, clean-cut-looking boy and was a pretty good ball player. And my Uncle Tom pitched for the Baltimore Orioles before they were in the major leagues. And my Uncle Joe went to my dad to Cincinnati and worked for Bob Housen. Bob Housen was a Ricky man, And the big red machine of 74, 75, 76, right along in there, was built by Uncle Joe and my dad and Bob Housen. And Branch Rickey was behind all those guys. They used his principles, so they do work. And I'm just sorry he didn't pay Frank more money than that. Because Frank could really hit the ball. He was a big, strong guy. He was my younger brother was a spring training when Frank was there, and he said Frank was always nice to him. He said, every time he sees me, he winks at me. So tough luck about your salary there, Frank, but I know what you mean. Elroy knows what you're talking about. That's all I got to say.
I just want to follow up those comments with something. I think Mr. Thomas certainly reminded us of what a complex figure Branch Rickey was, but I do want to throw him a little love here from a scouting report of Mr. Thomas that Rickey did in 1951. Thomas, outfielder. This was written June 25th, 1951. He can do everything, and everything is in caps. Perfect form at the plate and a lot of power. Should be able to hit any kind of pitching. But then a little later on in the report, Rickey says, he quotes, whom the Lord loveth, he chasteth. He chasteneth, I can't even pronounce that. And great players whom management like to see in Pittsburgh are to be found fault with if they are not as good as they should be. So again, I think this just highlights the complexity of Rickey. I'm sorry you didn't get your raise too. But he really did in his reports like Frank Thomas. By the way, this report is on the library's website. Anybody can go find it.
I wish I'd have seen that, and I'd have run back into his face.
Yeah, that's right. You would have taken it back. That's the power of information.
Can I say one more thing about Frank Thomas?
Please.
He used to hit him out of Forbes Field. There was a big clock. I was telling him that. Top the scoreboard out there. He hit him over the clock. He hit him so far you couldn't even see him. But I also wanted to get this in. Dick Stewart hit the hardest ball ever hit in Forbes Field, even harder than Frank hit him. He hit a line drive over dead center field. If anybody's there that saw that, I hope you back me up on that because it's hard to believe, but it was a line drive, dead center field. Frank hit him almost that far. He hit him way up in the air, though.
Yeah, I remember Rick, when Stewart came up in spring training, came to my locker. He says, you Frank Thomas? I says, yes. He said, how many home runs you hit your first full year? I says, 30. He says, I had to hit 40. I said, well, I hope you make the ball club. But the two longest balls that I've ever seen hit out of Forbes Field were by Josh Gibson from the Homestead Grays. He gave me my first baseballs. He hit two of them over there, 457 mark. Over the cage and everything.
Yeah, there was a batting
Stewart,
cage out
Stewart
there.
Hit his on top of the batting cage. So that's a pretty good ball. I mean, you know, you're supposed to hit more home runs in your home ballpark than you are away. Banks and I were fighting for the home run title in 58, okay? I hit 26 on the road and 9 in Forbes Field. And it should be the opposite. And Banks hit most of his in Chicago and less on the road. I played with 15 Hall of Famers, and I enjoyed my career, okay, and I loved it. And I'll tell you a story my mother always used to say. She says, if you want to be seen, walk erect. If you want to be heard, sit down and sit down. So that's what I'm the type of person that tell it as it is. I will not tell it behind your back. I will tell it right to your face. People don't like to hear the truth. But that's the type of person I am. And they have to accept me for that. If not, then that's their luck.
Do you have any memories of playing with the O'Brien twins?
Yes. The
O'Briens played against the Globetrotters, you know, and they beat the Globetrotters when the Globetrotters were playing it straight. Johnny, who is still alive, his brother died, Eddie, a little while ago. Johnny broke his nose. He had his nose broken in that game, and he was out for some of the third quarter, and then he came back. The Globetrotters called off the rest of that tour after the game, but they came to the Pirates in 53, and Johnny was a bit of a wise ass. You know, Bing Crosby was part of the ownership, and And he said, I hear you're coming to play baseball. And he says, nah, tennis is my racket. And Crosbury came from Spokane, said, you know, kid, I told gags like that 30 years ago, and they were better than that, and they chased me out of town. What was it like playing with the O'Briens, Frank?
Well, they were twins, okay? And so the manager, you switch it. If you wanted to put one in, put the other in. He said they're twins. He said, so they can bat whatever they want.
Hey, it's time for some of the questions from the audience. Frank, can you talk about having played for the three worst teams in baseball, the Pirates, the Cubs, and the Mets? Which was the most poorly run organization?
You want me to be honest? Well, I'll tell you. You know, when I was with the Mets, we lost 120 games. But a lot of you people don't know this, and you should because you're Sabre members, okay, and research and everything, and Jeffrey should know this also, okay. We lost 51 games by one run in the seventh, eighth, and ninth innings. And if we had won those 51 games, we'd have been right in the pennant, okay, fight for the pennant. So it's hard, you know. I'm the type of person that I go out there and I give 100% of the God-given ability given to me. And if I could go into the clubhouse and say to myself as I'm taking off my uniform, I gave 100%, I didn't care what anybody said. That's the way I felt, okay? And ballplayers have so much pride about themselves, and they go out every day. And even though you're down 15-1, you're still fighting because you love the game of baseball. It's the fairest sport that there is. No clock to beat you in baseball. Like last night, they played 13 innings. In Boston, they played 15 innings, okay? So that's the nice thing about baseball. Every other sport, except maybe tennis, you know, that can go on too. So, but that's a fair sport as far as I'm concerned. And I just love the game of baseball. I don't like what's going on with them, okay? I don't like the idea, say, you know, yeah, walk them. I've been in many games where the pitcher threw the ball wild and a run scored trying to walk the guy. So that's my opinion.
Do you have a Joe Adcock story?
Pardon me?
Another question came from our members. Do you have a Joe Adcock story?
No, I don't. I can just remember when Joe Adcock chased Ruben Gomez to the left field through the center field stands with a bat after he threw at him. But back then, you know, umpires have a lot of control today. If they would just let the players play, okay, the players will take care of the brushback pitches, okay? I can remember when Vernon Law was pitching, okay, and Murtaugh was the manager. And he says, Vern, I want you to knock that first pitcher that comes up down. Vernon says, Danny, I don't do that. And Danny says, well, then, it'd be $5,000 on my desk at the end of the game. And he knocked the guy down. That's the best way to do it, you know. Let the players handle it, and no one's going to get hurt.
Jeff, someone wants more knowledge about the baseball exhibit. How long is it going to run, and will it move to another city?
There's not an end date yet. In fact, I asked that very question because it's not. We have some cards on display out in the lobby, and help yourself to that. It gives a little bit of information about it, but they haven't put an end date on it, and they have not yet arranged for it to travel.
But for the first time, as I understood at Cooperstown, though, there is cooperation between Cooperstown and your exhibit.
That's right. That's right. Cooperstown lent. Artifacts, you know, bats, balls, gloves, things of that nature, spikes, and to complement the collections that we have here at the library.
And I really encourage you to go to the loc.gov and check out Branch Rickey's scouting reports. I did that before this panel. There are his fairly obvious praise of Steve Carlton as a high school pitcher and Don Dreas Drysdale, but here's someone who didn't make it, and here is one of the reasons, not having had to negotiate contract with Branch Rickey, that I came to like his humor. Here's a pitcher, Lee Redman, who I don't think made the majors. Quote, pig-eyed, pig-faced, 200-pound right-hander from Newport, Kentucky. A football player, and if he started at me, I'd run. He commanded a squad of Attila's invaders in Italy. But he has a real aptitude. He can learn to throw different pitches. And then someone who was never came close to making it. I think he is old enough to quit. He has not come from any place and is not going to anywhere. And another one, he is right where he needs to be, Dublin, Georgia. So the humorous side of him, I came to know, you know, from digging in.
There's another one on there. I'm going to make everybody look for it. It's almost haiku-like. Ricky wrote, can't run, can't hit, can't throw. That pretty much summed it up for that player. I checked that player who went on to have a coaching career in the minor leagues, was still alive as of a few months ago, and I just felt bad that scouting report is up there. But that's what Ricky was. He was very frank in a lot of these
and
reports.
You know, one of the famous quotes that you must have heard is that he said that precisely about Eddie Stanky.
I was going to say that.
He also said that about Koufax. Absolutely. Koufax worked out for the Pirates, and he was warming up. Sam Nairn was catching him. Balls were going 10 feet over. Hank. He said, boy, he can throw hard, but he don't know where it's going. Okay? But look at the pitcher he became. And the reason why he became that pitcher is because he worked at it. He was dedicated to it. Okay? And I tell you parents, if you have little kids that want to play baseball, okay, and this is what they really want to do, don't deter them from it, because if you do, they're not going to make it. You know, give them that desire if they have that great desire. Okay, it's not hard. I mean, it's not easy, but you got to work at it.
But, Frank, I would agree you're not keen on travel teams these days.
What was that again?
The travel teams. Kids are starting to play in travel teams when they're 8 years old, and a lot of the coaches, well, there's no license to be a coach. So a lot of kids are just not getting good training, and the joy that should come from playing all sports.
To be honest with you, Lee, coaches today don't know anything about baseball as far as Little League is concerned. Okay, I can give you an example. There was a coach that had a team playing against my team, okay, and my team had a man on first and third, and this coach was mouthed off and swearing at the kids and stuff like that. And I went over to my kid that was on third base. I says, now, when I ask the pitcher for the baseball and he throws it over, you run into home, okay? I asked him for the ball. He threw it over. Run scored. And the game's over. And the coach says, well, why is the game over? He says, well, the pitcher threw the ball over third base. I wanted to teach that guy a lesson. He didn't know anything about baseball, okay? And because he was so mean to the kids, I wanted to show him that, you know, he shouldn't be doing that stuff. Yeah. Taught him a lesson.
Another question from the audience. Was there a very good, great pitcher you had good success against? And was there a mediocre pitcher you just could not get a handle on?
Well, I got my first hit off Paul Minor, and I got 10 straight hits against him. All I had to do was take the bat up and put the batter in the ball, infielders would come together, outfielders would come together, the ball would drop, and then we're playing in Forbes Field against the Cubs, and he's 3-2, and he hit through behind me, and he laughed the whole time I was going down first base. But I hit him pretty good. Usually the pitcher that you hit for your first hit is a pitcher you're going to hit the rest of your career. Mm-hmm. And that was what, for me, as far as for Paul Minor. The toughest pitcher for me was Drysdale. I struck out 41 times against him in my career. 41 times.
Like going to the dentist.
A sweeping curveball, and you look for the fastball on the inside. It comes this way, and then you're looking for that, and then all of a sudden it gives you another big one. So, but you live and you learn. But, I mean, I hit my home runs off them and stuff like that, but still, you know, you're going to get so many hits. So many things are going to happen to you through your career, okay? And as I said to a couple of people who are up here, you know, they always talk about the 3,000 hits players get. No one ever says anything about the 10,000 outs they made. And that's what it is. So if the difference between a 300 hitter and not is one hit a week. That's all. Be a 300 hitter.
Is your greatest drill still being chosen by the players to be the third? You were chosen by the players to be the third baseman in the 58 All-Star game.
I relished the 1958 All-Star game because the players voted you in. And this is the way players are. If you're going good and they're honest and they're not the people like fans that'll stuff the ballot box, they'll vote you in. And I relished that because I made the starting lineup in. I made the air to lost the ball game, though, but that's beside the point. Ted Williams hit a ball right to me, perfect double play ball, and right through my legs.
Were they throwing sliders when you broke in, Frank? Or Jim, sliders. Did you see sliders in those days? Jim Constantine used to get them all out, and they couldn't figure out what was happening.
They had the spitter ball, too.
I doubt that.
Somebody asked me, says, how did you hit Gaylord Perry? I says, I hit the dry spot.
Jack, tell us a little bit about your playing career. You played at Salem College in West Virginia, right?
Yeah. For a year, and then I transferred to Pitt, and I had to study French and everything all day long, so I didn't play baseball. But yeah, I was one of the saddest days of my life. I'd seen a lot of good ball players. I used to go to games with my dad. And I knew what a good ball player was. I'd seen a lot of them. Most of the kids around my hometown didn't know what a good ball player could do, and they all thought they were going to go someplace. And I got to be about 16, 17 years old, and it wasn't going to happen. And it was one of the saddest days in my life, because you got to be really, really good to even get signed. And usually doesn't happen. They're amazing athletes, baseball players. And one of the heartbreaking things of happens to a lot of scouts, they see this halfback on the football team, or they see a great athlete, and they sign him, and he just can't play the game. He can't hit. He's got bored hands. He can't field a ground ball, and maybe he can't throw. And he can run like the devil on a football field, but can't play baseball. It's a hard sport.
You know the difference between players today and players in my time? You don't have anybody throwing out anybody from the outfield now. They don't have any arms at all. Mm-hmm. Ferrello had a great arm. Clemente had a great arm. Parker had a great arm. Calavito had a great arm. I had a great arm, okay? Nobody ran on us when I was with Pittsburgh, because you had Clemente in right, you had Verdun in center, and me in left. In my first game against the Dodgers, I threw three runners out, two at third and one at home in one ball game.
Wow.
Okay? And then when you do that and you're charging the ball, and if you miss it, they don't run because they know that you're charging the ball. There's a difference. The players today, I think the talent is so thinned out. I mean, you guys hitting 190 and making $4 million. Okay? If you didn't hit 250 when I played, you weren't in the major leagues because there was only eight teams in each league, 16 teams. That's the difference of today. Talent is thinned out.
Well, this has been a very special hour, and I want to thank Jack Bowen and Frank Thomas and Jeffrey Flannery and the Pittsburgh Sabre people for doing such a great job at this conference.
Anybody wants them?
Yes.